Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Mary. I am an alcoholic. And I have experience with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's an honor and a privilege to be here this weekend with you to share my experience with the 12 steps. When I was telling my family, they said, "You mean there's a group of people that are going to be listening to only you and your experience with the 12 steps the whole weekend? All 12 of them? And there's no one else?" I said, "Oh no, there's a gentleman and he's going to share his experience." And they just thought it was odd that someone would want to come up and listen for an entire weekend to hearing me speak. So, and I was thinking about my dad. You know, he said I was a Chatty Cathy my whole childhood. You know, I had the Chatty Cathy doll. And then it's so interesting because I work in a field where I do a lot of listening. So, you know, on my drive up, I was talking to God and I said, "You know, I have no idea. I have so many stories, so many antidotes over the past, you know, years that I said, you need to be the one that's driving this experience." So, I trust and rely on God today because I have been through the process, and I do believe that God won't disappoint you. Huh? So I came into the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1995, and I was 38 years old. I had spent that summer of 95 in an environment with other young families, and our children swam together. And there was this one woman that I thought was so cool, you know? And you're going to discover that before Big Book, I was really quite shallow. But, you know, so I had a criteria for people that I would hang out with. And Chris met that criteria. She was young. She was pretty. She was cool. Here you go. And she was, she read all the books that I read. And I just felt like I could tell her anything. So towards the end of the summer, we were planning a party, and she said that she wasn't a drinker. I said, "What do you mean you're not a drinker?" And because I had spent the whole summer drinking, and I was oblivious to the fact that she wasn't a drinker. And she says, "Oh no, Mary, I'm not. In fact, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for about 6 years. And you know, that little girl inside of me leapt." I said, "Really?" Because I had known that I had a problem with alcohol, but never had talked about it to anyone. And she said, "Yeah." I said, "Can I get back to you?" She said, "Anytime." So that was the end of August, and we bumped into each other in September, and she said, "Hey, do you want to have that talk?" And I said, "No, I'm not quite ready yet, you know?" And then I had gone to a fundraiser at the end of September, all dressed in my navy blue. It was a political fundraiser. And I walked across the parking lot, and I said, "Mary, I don't want you to have a drink tonight." So I'm having a conversation with myself. And I walked right into the fundraiser, and my girlfriend Gail was there, and she said, "I've been waiting for you. Let's go to the bar." And sure enough, I went to the bar. And I don't remember much after that. And it was a Tuesday, so Wednesday morning. I don't know how, I walked home. I don't know how where I left my car or anything at that point. And I remembered the conversation I had with Chris. So I called her. And I said, "Do you do that 12-step work?" And she said, "I do." I said, "I'd like to talk to you. I'm ready." And she came over. And she spent 2.5 hours listening to me as I poured. I think it was like going to confession, you know. I told her everything, and she said, "I think that you might be one of us. Would you like to come to a meeting?" And I said, "Yes." And so I spent months, you know. So October 19th, 1995 was my sobriety date, and I walked into a woman's meeting, and I heard for the first time that what I did walking across that parking lot, saying, "Mary, I don't want you to drink," and then drinking, it's called drinking without my permission. And I thought, oh my goodness. And so the journey of my sobriety began. It began when she disclosed that she was an alcoholic. And, you know, I've had incredible people in my life, as you'll hear over the weekend, how they have disclosed to me and modeled for me what it's like to be a woman in recovery today. So I went only to women's meetings because back when I was 38, men were the problem, you know. So we had alcohol and we had men. And so, you know, I went to my first 12 and 12 meeting, and they had invited me to share because I had met a marker. And so there's certain markers. There's the 1 month, there's the 2 month, and then there's, you know, 90 days. So I had 90 days, and I shared the first time about being in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I discovered was that I had been accumulating some knowledge because I had been going to these meetings. In this one particular meeting, I had shared the same paragraph I had read on Friday night, I read on Tuesday. And I thought that was such an epiphany that I read the exact same paragraph. And I thought it was important that all of you knew that I had read the same paragraph. And all I shared was that I had read that paragraph. There was no sharing, there was no aha moments, it was just, isn't that cool? You know, and I didn't realize how sick and how blocked off I was. But there was a woman in the room, we had a break, and she came up to me and she said, hey Mary, what step are you on? And I said, I have no idea. She said, well, that's obvious. I'm gonna give you my number, and I'm going to be your temporary sponsor. I said, that's terrific. She said, I want you to call me. Call me every morning. Even if I don't answer, just leave me a message. And so the first sponsorship began with Rosemary. And it was incredible. I would go to all the meetings that she told me to go to, and I would call her every day. Well, this one particular day, the morning, it got away from me. And because I was still doing the same thing. So I was young. I had a protocol, and that protocol was, of course, to make sure that I looked absolutely stunning when I walked into an AA meeting. So, and for me, that meant that there was a three-way mirror, right, when I got ready, so that I could see every angle of me that you could see. So I knew if I wanted to make a particular impression, I would know that I want you to look at this side of me, not that side of me. So this is my focus. You know, I'm a graduate from college. I have four children, and I'm spending 2 hours after they leave for school to get ready because I'm going to a mixed gender meeting. This is the state of mind that I was in early recovery. So I'm just trying to lay the groundwork of what God had to do with someone as shallow as I was. This was all I had at this point. So, you know, we were going through the big book, and I discovered in the doctor's opinion that I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And, you know, this went along with step one, right? That RID, people would say the word RID, and I didn't know what they were talking about until I saw it in black and white. And I could identify. And I just thought I was cranky sometimes. But they actually had language for it. And, you know, I also learned that I didn't have to stay this way. I mean, there are some promises in the doctor's opinion. In fact, he says that we can be recreated. And I was very impressed with that whole idea of being recreated. My language was a redo. When early in recovery, I just had all this remorse, you know. I had remorse and shame and a lot of guilt because I had spent my entire life up until this point in almost like an autopilot kind of existence. I was extremely thoughtless. And yet I would tell you that I was really quite committed to my family, quite committed to whichever boyfriend I was with at that time. But there was a great deal of self-absorption and self-centeredness. But I didn't have that language until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. But I, when I was, you know, in that early stage, I absolutely knew that I was powerless over alcohol. Because I could hear and identify in early recovery in that first year, men and women sharing their experiences. Their experiences with taking that first drink and how it set up that phenomenon of craving, and that you wanted a second drink, and then a third, and so on. And I could remember, because I had some perspective that first year, when my husband would try to help regulate, you know, well, Mary, maybe if you just stuck to wine, right? And I said, I think we read that, you know, if we only had beer only, or, you know, organic wines, or, you know, don't drink the Grand Marnier after dinner, you know, all these different things. And so I was struggling with, you know, trying to manage the alcohol. And in that first year, I would come home and I would say to him, you know, honey, I'm learning a lot about the physical part of this disease, that I really can't drink anything. And which disappointed him, you know, because foundationally our relationship was a lot of fun around alcohol. And I have since discovered that life is a lot easier, right? Life was tolerable when I was drinking. And then when you put the plug in the jug, it's not so tolerable. In fact, it was very, very difficult. And I remember sitting in a meeting, and this is how gracious the woman that was sharing her experience, strength, and hope was. She talked about her and her husband coming into AA together, and that when she stopped drinking, she didn't know how to have sex anymore. And I thought, oh my God, how is it that she's talking about her relationship, her sexual relationship with her husband, so matter-of-factly? And I just kind of leaned in and listened. And she said to the group, yeah, I just struggled. I told them I felt like I was really young and that I just couldn't have sex with him. So I went home that day and I said to my husband, you know, honey, I'm really struggling because I feel like I'm about emotionally 13 years old. And at that time, our daughter was 12. She was going to be 13. And I said, look at how young she is. Would you have sex with a 13-year-old? And he said, Mary, of course not. I'll give you some time. So a few weeks went by, and we were crossing each other in the hall at home. And he says, hey, you 17 yet? And so the journey continued because I was able to identify that, you know, somewhere along the line I had stopped growing emotionally. And you hear it in the halls, you know. How old were you when you picked up your first drink? You probably stopped growing emotionally then. And so, you know, the whole idea of step one, you know, admitting that you're powerless over alcohol and that your life is unmanageable, I could admit that I was an alcoholic because of the phenomenon of craving. I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and that I needed something spiritually. But I couldn't tell you that I felt like my life was unmanageable. And it wasn't until I got into Big Book and sat with a sponsor, and she said to me, so, this was 1999, it was May, and I was sitting with her because I had gone through 3 years with Rosemary, you know, going to meetings, reading the book, and I would parrot what she said. because Rosemary had a great reputation in the Merrimack Valley. She was it. She could quote the book. She had stories. She had a gruff voice. She had a character. When she spoke, you could hear a pin drop. I mean, there were a lot of attractive things that I witnessed about her. So I became a really good chameleon and adopted her way. Didn't really unpack much except adopting Rosemary's way. And I can only share with you my truth today because I have this perspective. If you had said anything to me when I was in it, which a couple of people were brave enough to say, you know, do you have your own story? Do you have your own language? You know, you sound like your sponsor. You know, she has her own story. And I didn't know and understand what they were talking about. But Rosemary left. And it was September of 98. And my solution to her leaving was to go to graduate school. Because I had my third year medallion at Pretty Three. And I had it in my pocket. She was leaving. And she didn't set me up with another sponsor. She didn't do anything like that, right? So my meetings went from 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 to 1. I woke up December, restless, irritable, and discontent, and I knew I had to get to a meeting, and I didn't. My husband had to work. I had 4 children. All 4 of them were in basketball. And I found myself in a gym from 9 a.m. until 4 in the afternoon. And the next thing I know, it's a good idea to have a drink. And by the grace of God, it was only that afternoon. It was a Saturday. My husband walked into the kitchen and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I am so angry, and I don't know what to do." And I didn't think of the jaywalker. I didn't think of Fred or Jim. I didn't think about Bill. I didn't think about anyone. All I thought about was how angry I was, how restless I was, and how discontent I was. And when you don't go to meetings, and you're not in contact with the fellowship, and you're not doing the drill, that's what happened. That's what happened to me. My best thinking was to open the Crispa as I'm getting ready for dinner, cracking open one of my husband's beers, and waiting for the bells and whistles. And there were no bells and whistles. So I called that sponsor that had left, and she said, "Well, clearly you missed something. Why don't you go out and get drunk?" She couldn't identify with taking a sip, couldn't identify with my story, and hung up on me. So I called someone else, and they said, "You missed something. And there is another kind of meeting that I'd like for you to go to." And she brought me to Linfield in Massachusetts. And I heard a woman speak, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And she said she'd be honored to. And we sat and we were talking. And when you go through the process and you begin to read the preface and the forewords and doctor's opinion and the first steps that are around step one, right, the first set of readings, she said, "Well, Mary, you know, you have no problem admitting that you're powerless, yet you can't see the unmanageability of your life." And she began to look at me and she said, "So you don't think that having a relationship outside of your marriage is unmanageability?" And I thought, well, maybe. And we were in the same faith tradition. We worshiped in a similar church. And she began to talk to me from a spiritual part. And she said, "Well, you know, I think adultery is a sin. And sin simply means separation from God. So how can you be operating with God if you're in a state of this separation from Him?" And I said, "Yeah, probably you're right." And so we began. We began to look at all the pieces in my thinking that was causing this unmanageability. Because truly, until I could fully concede that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable, could I then begin to move to step two. And so we sat and we discussed the unmanageability, thinking that it was a good idea to go to graduate school instead of going to meetings, thinking that it was a good idea to, lie to my husband about the checkbook, thinking that it was a good idea to live a life that was filled with a duality, duplicity. I was living a life of duplicity, and I was doing this without even an awareness. And I don't know if I would have ever been able to become so willing to allow someone to unpack my life if she wasn't so willing to unpack hers. And she modeled for me what it was like to share transparently, to be vulnerable, and to have a trust of anonymity so that I could sit and listen to her story and she could point out areas that she was blocked, where she was living a life of duplicity, where alcoholic thinking took over, when it took over, how it took over, and that you can absolutely begin to surrender and ask God to begin to restore you. And that took a while. That took many months for me to begin to sit and have the willingness to have her smash one mask after another, after another, after another. Because I had a whole closet full of masks that I would put on depending on where I was going. And, I have since, and as we go through the steps, we'll share with you how I got there, but that's not what this step one is all about. It's where she met me where I was, and she was equipped with enough of herself, because she had had a spiritual awakening, that she could sit and point out in the most loving way what was the truth. And I too can sit with someone who is sharing, as we go through the readings, about unmanageability, because we come in so full of fear. I was so chock full of fear that I had this pride, and my pride was so big, it was like foundational. And in that pride box was all these masks, and I had all this armor of lies and deception and pretend. And she said, "Mary, you don't have to live like that." And it was the beginning of discovering my true self. And I didn't have that language. And I'll learn more about that after I experience that spiritual awakening. But step one for me was such a crucial time of unpacking and preparing me to really look at the dishonesties that I had been carrying my entire life. And it was an arsenal of protection, and I didn't realize that. And we'll get to that when we get to step four, how we have created all these things and to protect the wounded person. And I didn't know I was wounded. She shared that until, I went through and began to avail myself to understand who this God was that was going to give me an opportunity to be recreated. So the girl that came in at 38 is now in her 40s, and she is willing to begin to set aside her anger with her husband. And because I said to her, "I just don't think I can go through this process with my husband, and she said, "Do you trust me?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I want you to go through it. I want you to just focus on what we're going to be doing. And if you still want to divorce him, I know a great lawyer." And I was in. So I was able to just like table my relationship with my husband and begin this process and begin to trust that what she was sharing and what she was telling me, and how if I was just able to surrender, not think about drinking, and to begin to look at my thinking, which is more in step two, and just trust, go to meetings, and she gave me a protocol of what I had to do, how many big book meetings I had to go to, and how I was to rearrange some things within the house, because unmanageability is a form of undiscipline, and she was going to begin to help me become disciplined. And I thought I was disciplined because I was in school and I was meeting a criteria for school, and she said, "That's very, very good, but what I'm suggesting is an interior one, right? Not just what's going on in the outside environment." So I'm learning that there's an interior environment and there's an exterior environment. And so my step one experience has continued. And so present day, I can say that when I wake up and I say to God, "I'm so grateful that I'm an alcoholic, and that today the unmanageability could still creep in with my thinking, and so I surrender my thoughts, and I ask God to, let go of any thought that, help me to let go of any thought that is not from Him, so that I can be of use and service today." So step one never really leaves, because unmanageability can creep in, because I've only had a spiritual experience, and my spiritual, how, if I'm fit, then I can certainly do whatever God has asked me to do for this day. And so I thank you so much for your attentiveness, and that's my experience with step one.
My name's George. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, George.
I want to thank you for inviting me to speak. This is a real honor. It took me almost 6 hours to get here from Orleans on Cape Cod. Before I start, I heard a really good joke, right? There's no group conscience. I can tell a joke, can I?
Yeah.
It's clean. It involves alcohol. It involves recovery. It involves spirituality. So can I tell a joke? All right. And I'm not, I don't want to offend anybody's ethnicity, but I have to stand up. So anyway, Peter goes walking into this bar, right? And he sits down and he orders a glass of wine. And he's enjoying the glass of wine. He's looking around. And he calls the bartender over and he goes, "Hey, is that Jesus sitting down the end of the bar?" Bartender says, "Yep, that's him." He says, "Well, send him a glass of wine on me." So the bartender brings Jesus a glass of wine. A little while later, Joseph comes walking in and he sits down. And he orders a glass of beer. So the bartender gives him the beer, and he's enjoying the beer, and he's looking around, and he calls the bartender over. He goes, "Hey, is that Jesus sitting down the end of the bar?" He goes, "Yep, that's him." He goes, "Well, send him a beer on me." So Jesus gets the beer. A little while later, Tony comes in, right? He orders a shot of tequila. So he drinks the shot, and he's looking around, and he says to the bartender, "Is that Jesus sitting down the end of the bar?" Bartender says, "Yeah, that's him." He goes, "Well, give him a shot of tequila on me." So a little while later, Jesus gets up to leave the bar, and he stops off at Peter, and he taps him on the shoulder, and he says, "Hey, thanks for that glass of wine. It was great." Peter says, "You know, I've had bursitis in my shoulder for years. I can't believe it. Feels great now." He walks over to Joseph, and he says, "Thanks for the beer," and he taps him on the knee. And Joseph says, "You know," he says, "I was going to have a knee replacement. I think I'm going to call off the surgery. It feels great." He goes over to Tony to thank him for the shot, and Tony says, "Don't touch me, I'm on full disability." All right. Anyway, so All right, my name is George. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, George.
I remember the Norton Big Book Step Study meeting, and I've been around for a while, and without a doubt, this Big Book process has changed my life, and I always refer to it as the Hotel California. I can always check out, but I could never leave, you know. Tell you how I started. I started sipping beers. My dad gave me a sip of beer when I was like 5 or 6 years old. He's not an alcoholic, and I loved it. So after that, hey, Dad, could I have another sip? And it was cute to give me a sip of beer. And then, you know, around 9 or 10, I'm taking sips when he's not looking, you know. And then in my early teens, our parents lived in a nice neighborhood, a lot of parties. So my friend and I, when the party was over, we would steal liquor from all the stash that was on the tables. And then in my mid-teens, I lived in a town where there was a naval base, so we could always get sailors to buy us liquor. And then around 18, you know, we had phony IDs, so we could get it more frequently. I went to college, and I flunked out due to the abuse of alcohol. I joined the Marine Corps. I get out of that, and I went back to college, and there was this really cool restaurant in town, right on a marina, and I started working there. And an hour and a half after I was in that restaurant, I had this epiphany, and I said, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. And I quit college the next day, and I set a goal to be in the restaurant business. I actually carried a blank key on my key ring for 4 years to remind me that I was going to be in the restaurant business someday. And I loved it, you know? And I could drink every day. And I was a daily drinker. From the time I was 21 till the time I was 37, I drank every day. Not 5 days a week, not 6 days a week. I didn't, you know, stay away from it for a week or two. I was 7 days a week. I worked 6 days a week, and I drank every day. And then on my day off, I partied and I drank. I had a lot of early success in my life. I opened my first restaurant at 25, and the alcohol was free, and it flowed like water, and things are going along real good. But then, as Bill Wilson talks about the boomerang, so, you know, it wasn't too long before the alcohol, like the boomerang, turns in flight, and it eventually, I had 3 locations, and I was wrecking cars, I was waking up in places I shouldn't be with people I shouldn't be with. And my wife decided to see a marriage counselor, and she went there a couple of visits, and then they asked if I would come. So I said, all right. So after this little intro, the marriage counselor, he says to me, you know, your wife seems to think you drink too much. I said, well, if you work 6 days a week, 80 hours a week, and had a restaurant, you drink too. He goes, well, you know, you don't look like an alcoholic. He says, would you mind going down to Edgehill, this evaluation center in Newport? It's not there any longer. I said, yeah, I'll go down there. So anyway, they give me this evaluation, and after a couple hours, they diagnosed my condition as chronic, said I had been one for a number of years. They wanted me to stay for 30 days. I couldn't do it because I got my business to run. So I didn't want anybody to know I was an alcoholic, even though I could roll cars over driving home. So I went like 3 towns away to an open meeting, and I walked in. And I was well received, and I loved it. You know, I thought when I went into my first AA meeting, I thought I was coming to AA to die. I thought this was the end of the road. I was going to see guys with dirty trench coats, pints hanging out of their pockets, and the back of their loafers bent over, right? And I walk in, and everybody's smiling and laughing, you know. So I really embraced it. It was I was all in. You know, started making the coffee, selling the raffle tickets, going on commitments. And then it was, Matt Talbot retreats, Alcathons. And but I was still a long way away from those promises that I would see once in a while on these walls and these banners. So I'm at a social event with the president of the Mass Restaurant Association. And I says, man, I'm telling you, I'm really in the weeds. I got myself painted into a corner financially. I got 3 restaurants going at the same time. My life is crazy. My marriage is on the rocks. Financially, I've painted myself into a corner. And plus, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And he goes, well, you know, there's a guy on the Cape that's got multiple units, and he's in AA. He seems to be pretty squared away. Why don't you give him a call? So I call this fellow up, and he's listening to me for about a half an hour. And then he says, do you have a big book? And I said, yeah, I got 2 or 3 of them. And he says, do you read it? And I says, no, I give it to the newcomer and tell him to read it. Especially chapter 5, how it works, you know? So he says, well, why don't you come on down to my house and we'll have a little chat. And so I go to his house, I don't know, a couple days later. It was on a Thursday night, Thursday afternoon. And so he starts talking to me. And he says, have you done the 12 steps? And I said, oh, yeah, I've got 12 meetings. I know all about them. So he comes back out of his den, and he's got 12 notebooks. Boom! And he drops them on the table. He says, this is the fourth step. And I had no idea what he was talking about. So he says, I'm going to take you to a big book step study meeting. And he says, it'll be like nothing you've ever seen. So this was the highest big book meeting. This is back in, I don't know, maybe 1988 or whatever. So I walk into this meeting, and I'm like, is this an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? And I'm looking around for banners, right? Because there's structure, there's discipline, they're ringing a bell, everybody's staying on, is focused. And I'm like, oh my God, I've never seen anything like it. And there's like 80 guys in there brimming over with self-reliance and contentment, you know? And I said, I don't know what these guys have done, but I want this. I really, really want it. So I asked them to be my sponsor. And I started my journey through these 12 steps. The doctor's opinion, incidentally, I listened to a doctor speak one time. It's considered the finest paper ever written on alcoholism. And the only place it was ever published is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's nice to know that in these kinds of meetings that we read this carefully, because there's a tremendous amount of, you know, information here. For me, I didn't know for the first 3 years in AA, I thought drinking was the problem. I just, you know, drink, that everything's okay. And I didn't understand why I couldn't drink until the doctor's opinion talks about the allergy, that my body does not process alcohol like a normal person. When I put alcohol in my system, there's more, there's a craving that takes over. And I'm also allergic to a few other things. I'm allergic to poison ivy. I get near poison ivy. Regardless, as much as I try not to break out into, you know, blisters and itch, and it's going to happen. I have no control over that. I'm also allergic to curry, right? I can't go by an Indian restaurant and go in and have curry. I get sick because my body just does not process curry the way most people do. I'm also allergic to the sun. I mean, I work on the beach, too. But the first day that I'm in the sun, that first day, I not only get sunburned, but I get sun poisoning. I get sick. I blister. I get welts on my hands. So there are several other things that I'm allergic to other than alcohol. But none of those things cause me to wreck cars, make bad business decisions. They don't break my moral compass. But alcohol does. So what's the antidote? What's the solution? Well, I found that antidote and that solution in the big book, that I have to think, there's got to be a power greater than myself that can rearrange my thinking. I got to be defragged, like a computer term, you know. I got to be rewired, you know. And that's what the rest of these steps are all about, you know. I also, and I'm not by any means putting down Open AA. I go to an open discussion meeting every morning at 7 o'clock. But the big book is, in my opinion, is where the real recovery is. And I felt the first 2 or 3 years, I was just dancing on the high notes. You know, it's in this big book that you really go. It's an inside job, and that's where I found the great truth. I also this doctor's opinion. I like to say I heard the dog whistle reading the doctor's opinion. And it says that he accepted the plan outlined in this book. For the first 3 years in AA, I didn't know there was a plan. I just thought you kind of winged it. You know, if you walked into a 12 and 12 meeting and they were on step 8, and you went to another one, they're on step 2, there was no real plan, you know. And it was in that big book step study meeting that I started to see the plan that's outlined in this book. And I'm like, are you kidding me? There's an actual plan? And it's just been a great thing. I get some things that I write down over the years, and it says that he must be sold. He became sold on the ideas in this book, and that's what has happened to me. I am sold on this book. There's very few paragraphs in this book that I can't personally identify with. Our group did a traditions meeting a few years ago and did a lot of research on this book, and The Big Book, counting its sales in its worldwide publication, is second now only to the Bible. I mean, that's how powerful this book is, you know. And to it's got to be the world's best-kept secret, you know. So anyway, that's my experience with, you know, being powerless over alcohol. I have an allergy to it. My body does not process it. And the unmanageability, again, at this first meeting with my sponsor, he's listening to me, and he says to me, he goes, I like word pictures and metaphors, right? So he goes, you know what you remind me of, George? And I said, what's that? And there's a few people in here that probably remember the Ed Sullivan Show. Well, this guy used to come out with sticks, and he would spin these plates on the sticks, right? He'd get one going, he'd get two going, and three going, and then this one would wobble, and he'd get down. So he'd go up, and he had seven or eight of them going, right? He says, that's what you remind me of, the guy in the Ed Sullivan Show. I got three restaurants going. I'm in a real estate development project. I'm on the verge of divorce. You know, there's all kinds of drama in my house, and I'm still spinning plates, you know. So eventually the plates all came down and crashed, and we'll talk about that at a later step. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me because I needed to find a different way to live. My sponsor said that there are laws, there are truths, there are principles that govern this world that we live in, and he says, you are living in violation of nearly every one of them. It went in one ear and out the other, although I do remember it, but it wasn't until later on in this process was I able to see, especially the unmanageability. I mean, you know, I got 100 employees, three restaurants, and putting up houses. What are you talking about? But it was in the fourth step that I was able to look in the rearview mirror and just see how unmanageable my life was. Also, I have a type A personality. My sponsor says you have insatiable energy or something, and then fueled with drinking every day. You know, of course, this is before I got sober. And he says, it's no wonder your life is a mess. So when it all came down, I had to start over again. And like I said, I'll talk about that at a later step. And I applied these principles that I learned in this process. And it has changed my life, and I just can't say enough about recovery. And the unmanageability again, I could not manage to go a day without a drink, but after the drink was put down, my life was still unmanageable because the drive, the insatiable drive, and the type A personality, wanting to be a big fish in a small pond, that had not been arrested yet. So it was losing it all before I could start over again. So that's my experience on step one and step two. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the joke. And that's it.